for the week of January 24th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 309, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Park City, Utah, at the Sundance Film Festival, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in snowbound New York City, I'm Michael Giltz. Is there snow in Sundance, Utah?
Well, it's not Sundance, Utah. It's Park City, Utah. And yes, there is snow. Although I will tell you, Michael, I think you may, being in New York City, have beat us out for the amount of snow you have.
Absolutely. Isn't it called Sundance for just that week or two? Don't we just change the name from Park City to Sundance?
Kind of, yeah. It's still considered Park City, Utah.
Right. So the weather was the big story here in New York. Everything's fine. Of course, a snowstorm. We can deal with it. But it did have an impact on the entertainment industry. Of course, as weather, it's serious. People die. You know, I mean, weather is serious. Hot, cold, rain, sun, whatever. But, you know, what we care about is the entertainment industry. And so not to be glib, but the weather, oh my God, the weather, it depressed the movie box office. That's what we care about. Broadway shut down on Saturday. That is a rare thing. Broadway does not often shut down. Basically, if the public transportation system shuts down, then Broadway shuts down. So it does not happen often, but it did happen on Saturday. And of course, our hearts go out to the people with tickets to Hamilton.
Yes, because I know how much those tickets cost now as I'm trying to get some for my kids. And the very seats that I sat in that you helped me get, Michael, back in September of last year, and they were expensive back then. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They were really expensive. They're now $1,200 each on the secondary market. Right. And they weren't like the best seats in the house either. They were good seats. They weren't.
Weren't there second row balcony?
They were first row balcony.
No, those are great seats. Those are great seats. Those are great seats to a Broadway show like that in that house. Those are great seats. A play, maybe you don't want to be in the balcony front row, but front row balcony is awesome. So those are primo seats. But yes, and the people on Saturday, they don't get to see the show on another date. They're like,
no, that's
they're
true.
Like, we can't. Where are we going to move you? Show's sold out. So they literally lose. They just lost the lottery. What a nightmare for them. But at least they can take comfort in listening to Showbiz Sandbox. And if they do, what will they hear about?
Well, on this week's show, we'll talk about, guess what, Michael? Diversity in Hollywood, diversity at the Oscars, diversity at Sundance, and diversity on Showbiz Sandbox. Okay, not so much the last bit there. You know, why critique yourself when you could be critiquing someone else? I'm at the Sundance Film Festival, as we mentioned.
And so naturally, on caffeine.
That's true. naturally, we'll spot some trends up here and talk about the best movies that I've seen, not to mention the record-setting deal for the new film Birth of a Nation, which I just got shut out of because, well, we'll get into that later.
It's long overdue that they did a remake of that D.W. Griffith classic.
I don't think it's actually a remake, but we'll get into that. The Producers Guild, by the way, Michael, they named their best film of the year. And like pretty much every award before it, they made clear this year's Oscar race is wide open. Still, I'd be willing to invest in The Big Short. Get it? Because it's an investment thing. Okay. During Inside Baseball, we'll look at the many proposals for increasing diversity at the Oscars, which ones would work, and what the Academy actually did. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also look at box office profits, Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, you name it. Anywhere we can get info on box office, we pull it out. And the number one movie around the world with $50 million is Oscar frontrunner The Revenant. $50 million over the weekend, $225 million worldwide. This movie is doing a great job of capitalizing on its Oscar attention. And number two around the world is Star Wars The Force Awakens. Another $38 million worldwide. It's at $1,940 million and counting.
Oh, will it hit the $2 billion mark? That's the big question.
Well, it will certainly get another $60 million. What it will have trouble doing is catching up to Titanic. It needs to gross, what is it?
Like another $700 million
It needs to gross like $400 million, I think, or $270 million. I wrote it down somewhere so I would know.
Write it on your hand. That way you just look at your hand. Be a professional broadcaster.
Is that what you did in grade school?
Well, yes, but I got sent to the principal's office for that because somebody called it cheating.
Well, I can't find that, but tell us the news about Star Wars changing its release date. Well, this is Star Wars 8, of course. They moved their release date from summer to December of 2017.
That's right. And actually, I was with John Fithian on, what was it, like Thursday of last week, Wednesday or Thursday of last week, and he is the head of the National Association of Theater Owners here in the U.S., and actually all over the world. But he was telling a number of people that the actual cinema exhibition industry in the U.S. increased the employment in the U.S. by like 20 or 30,000 employees. Some absurd number. Yeah, they hired all of these temporary workers to
increase employment. Temporary workers.
Well, it does. When
you're saying for a week or 2 weeks, they had
for the month. No. This is only for the month of December. We're only talking about the month of December.
Yeah, again. I wouldn't really tout that. We hired somebody for a couple weeks. Thank you, Star Wars. That's not really something to be shouting up and down about. The important thing is that, as others noted and we mentioned on our show, hey, Star Wars came out in December. The next Star Wars, Rogue One, comes out in December. Why not make it an annual tradition? And that's apparently what the studio decided. I don't think there's any hugely compelling reason for them to have moved the movie except to say, hey, let's make this a Christmas tradition. So that's what they've done. And now that means a bunch of other movies have to decide what to do. Pirates of the Caribbean moved, Jumanji moved, Spider-Man moved, and now Steven Spielberg is a little annoyed because he's there with Ready Player One, which was already set to open on that day in 2017, and he has to decide whether to blink and move. The answer is
he's going to blink.
You should.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And it's really not him. It's the studio. And I can tell you that, you know, even Fithian was saying, hey, you know, I really wanted that film, Star Wars Episode 8, in May for our, you know, for our theaters. But you know what? It's actually great. It worked out great this year to have it in December, and it's going to work out great in 2017 to have it in December. So it doesn't matter. And guess what? He predicted when a film like Star Wars moves, it's like a musical chairs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the one that's in theaters right now needs to gross another $250 million in order, roughly, in order to pass Titanic, which is number two of all time. That's a hard row. That's probably not going to make that, I don't think, unless, like Titanic, it gets released again in theaters. Rogue One or come 2017, maybe in the summer, they release Star Wars Episode 8, you know? And say, hey, remind yourself of how much you loved it. And, you know, they may be able to get a couple $10, $20, $50 million out of it worldwide like that.
Well, and isn't the Titanic number, doesn't that include the re-release with 3D?
Of course it does. Absolutely.
And, yeah, okay.
That's
all right.
Absolutely justified. Of course it does. So does the many re-releases of Gone with the Wind and Snow White.
No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Well, then why bring it up? Of course it does.
No, so I was agreeing with you. In my bringing it up, I was trying to agree with you, and look at what I get for agreeing with you. Although, one thing I will say before we move on from Star Wars is the big news about Star Wars, if you want to call it that, is, oh my goodness, it's slowing down in China. It's not doing as well in China.
Everybody's talking screens, as we said.
Yeah, so
That's the story. The story is you're on fewer screens. It's a lot harder to make the same amount of money. So that to me, like, they kneecapped that movie. They put it in the worst possible location, and then literally a week into its run, they cut down its screen pretty substantially.
You missed the opportunity to say they kneecapped that movie like Tonya Harding.
I wasn't trying to make a Tonya Harding joke.
Okay, fine.
I will say, speaking of Spielberg, however, there was a fascinating note about Jurassic World. As an aside, in Hollywood Reporter, they talked about why this movie took so long to get made. And of course, all these movies are big bets. You know, Star Wars, the estimated budget is $200 million. And we claim we know when they hit profitability. But of course, we don't know the actual contracts and deals that are made. We're just making very rough estimates based on the shadowy information we do have. Turns out for Jurassic World, it took them a long time to make a sequel, not because the budget was so big, which it was, but because Steven Spielberg insisted, and why not, on the terms of his original deal with Universal. That gave him 50% of total net. So it's gross revenue minus the cost of making and releasing the film. So yes, they're making of the film maybe budget a little, maybe pad a little bit, but it's not like when you talk about net profits never appearing. Total net is a much easier number to get and to make happen, and the studio doesn't f around with it, because the only people who get that are people like Steven Spielberg. Right. So if he that's just for producing it, by the way, that was the deal. So, and of course, I assume that by gross revenue, obviously they mean the money the studio actually gets back. They don't mean the box office reports. So that means Jurassic World made $1.6 billion worldwide. That means the studio got back about $725 million worldwide. They spent about $375 million making and marketing the movie. That's, of course, a rough estimate. That means Spielberg probably made about $125 million.
Which is why he can turn around and invest $50 million of that into DreamWorks or Amblin Partners, which is what he did when he set up the new company over at Universal again.
And still go out to lunch.
Yeah, I think you might do that. You know what? Heck, go to dinner.
So Revenant,
go to lunch and dinner.
So the Revenant made $50 million over the weekend. Star Wars The Force Awakens made $37 million over the weekend. And The Fifth Wave made $26 million. It's at $38 million worldwide and counting because it opened up overseas and in other territories. So that's where that young film is about young girls fighting dystopian future. You know, the aliens are attacking and she's trying to save the world. It feels, of course, like a retread of all the other movies like The Hunger Games and Divergent and so on. And that's kind of how it's being treated by audiences. But it costs $38 million to make. And already just two weekends into its run, it's making $38 million worldwide. And number four is Ride Along 2. That made $20 million over the weekend. That's at $70 million and counting. And number five, another movie doing a great job of capitalizing on its Oscar nominations. That is The Big Short. $28 million it cost to make this movie. It made $13 million over the weekend, and it's at just under $90 million worldwide. And number six is Dirty Grandpa, the most viciously reviewed movie of the year so far. Of course, it's only January, but I'll bet it's the most viciously reviewed movie of the year come December 31st. Oh my
there
God.
There are a lot of bad movies to come, my friend. Trust me.
But those were some nasty. They were like, this movie's a sin. It's a crime against humanity.
Only because Robert De Niro is in it. I told you when I saw Zac Efron and Robert De Niro, I said, "That I get it, but you have to do something really special to pull it off." And guess what? They didn't.
Well, I don't. My friend said it was hilarious, so I'm looking forward to checking it out. Maybe they're just all blue bloods or blue-haired grannies. I don't know. Maybe they're a clean-eared grandma. It made $13 million over the weekend, but viciously negative reviews. However, just like the other movies in North America, it did pretty good given the snowstorm. At number seven is The Boy, a horror flick that made $12 million over the weekend. That means it made its budget back in the first weekend. That's great news for the studio that distributed it.
Yeah, that's STX Entertainment. And I can tell you, and I thank Steve Elzer for this. He sent some figures through along with some facts. I was surprised to see that 75% of those who saw this film, guess what they were? Guess what, which gender they were? I'll even narrow it down. Which gender do you think it was?
Which gender do I think most of the people who saw The Boy was? I'm going to guess men.
75% female. I was shocked. And
what?
And yeah, and some ridiculous number under the age of 25.
So it was all 20-year-old women.
Yes,
really?
Correct.
I didn't know horror films trended female. Do they usually?
I don't know. That's a good question. I believe they do, but I can double check.
Well, there's
not right now.
Something
but
I learned right now. And number eight is the Will Ferrell comedy Daddy's Home, another $11 million. That's at $200 million worldwide. And then a number of movies also around $10 million, 13 Hours and Creed both made about $10 million worldwide. 13 Hours is at $34 million and counting. Will that play overseas? I don't know. And Creed has begun to open up overseas. That's where it made most of its money over the weekend. It made $9 million. It's in 38 territories, and it's at $150 million worldwide. Sure, Sylvester Stallone is in a supporting role, but this is essentially a film directed by a black man, starring a black man with a female romantic lead who is a person of color. So the idea that movies can't play around the world when they are starring or about people of color just doesn't pan out. And number 11 is The Hateful Eight, the Quentin Tarantino movie, another $9 million. That's at $96 million worldwide. And then scrolling down a little bit, we'll get to a movie that wasn't on the list for RentTrack because it only opened on Saturday in a few previews. And of course, their information didn't get to them in time. But Kung Fu Panda 3 played on Saturday for 3 hours in China. It was a sneak preview. They were only allowed to do it for 3 hours. That means they were able to work in two screenings because it's a short movie. There was a cold snap in China, apparently. So even the weather was not helpful for that. But it made, on Saturday, in a three-hour time span, it made $6.4 million. So, you know, it's opening up in North America and around the world this weekend. Great news from that early sneak preview in China. It made it onto the chart at around number 14 worldwide with just 3 hours of play.
That just goes to show you the power of China.
That's right.
Or the size, really, of China.
That's right. So we do have some box office news, don't we? That we have ticket prices around for the 2015. At the end of the year, they tally it up and they tell us what the average ticket price was. This is obviously ignores how many tickets were sold at a discount, regional differences, IMAX and 3D and large format screens versus regular screens, big cities versus small towns. But if you add it up, Sperling, what's the news?
Well, the news is not good if you're trying to save money. That's for sure. Because going to the movies has never actually been more expensive than I get. Last year, according to the National Association of Theater Owners, who I just plugged earlier with Mr. Fithian, the average price of a movie ticket hit record highs in the fourth quarter of 2015. Thanks, Star Wars The Force Awakens, which, by the way, did record business in IMAX. The average ticket price also hit a record high for the entire year. Prices naturally go up in the summer and December when blockbusters predominate and are a little lower when less expensive when, you know, there are smaller films, i.e. less 3D and premium format type movies like Dirty Grandpa. You know, so the ticket prices are probably going to go down in the first quarter, or maybe not because of Star Wars. I don't know. But fourth quarter of 2015, the average ticket price was $8.70, the highest ever for any single quarter. And 2015 as a whole, the ticket price was $8.43 on average. In 2014, to give you some perspective, it was $8.17.
Right. It rose from that year at almost more than 25 cents. 26 cents it rose from the year before. A quarter. Cost you 2 bits extra to get to the movies this year. But of course, I live in New York City and I look at 870 and I think, wow, I wish it was that.
I was just going to say these numbers always cause one reaction from people in New York, Los Angeles, and several coastal cities. And that is, where can I see a movie for $8?
Yeah, I love it when I go into the heartland. We also had some news from Australia. It is official now. Andrew Einsbruch, I'm making him sound German. Einsbruch. Andrew Einsbruch from sent us a link to a story about Australian cinema. We had early reports that now it's official. Australian cinema made by Australia, had its highest grossing year in history, with local movies grossing $88 million in revenue, topping easily the previous record of $63 million back in 2001. And yes, Sperling, that's a record, even if you adjust for inflation. The big movies are, of course, Mad Max Fury Road, The Dressmaker, The Water Diviner, Oddball, and Paper Planes. So we'll have to see how many of those make the leap to here to North America and the rest of the world. Certainly Mad Max Fury Road has been a strong delivery. Again, it was a very expensive movie to make, and it's going to be long-term a profitable film for them. But when you're looking at just the reported budget and how it did at worldwide box office, that's not a slam dunk, which means Correct. There may not be sequels despite all the Oscar love and the fact that, frankly, it was a terrifically fun movie.
Yeah, I'm still not as sold on that movie as others, but then I wasn't sold on the original as much as others.
Oh, I love Road Warrior, and I really enjoyed this movie a lot. It'll definitely be on my best of the year list, which I'm not done compiling. I still have to watch some movies, including some movies that debuted at Sundance in 2015, last January. Were there any awesome movies that you've seen at Sundance, Sperling?
Well, let's see. I can tell you the ones I was shut out of.
No, Aussie?
Because apparently... Oh, Aussie movies.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I didn't see any Australian movies.
Well, I wrote a coverage of Sundance without actually attending Sundance. It saves me time and money. And I said lots of movies were screened. Some got good reviews. Most will never be seen by paying audiences, which is true of all film festival. And deals were made. How did my predictions pan out?
Yeah, they actually panned out quite well, Michael. And I think actually this may be the way I cover the festival in the future, the same way you did. Because I have to say, and I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant here.
It's just because we're jaded people who've gone to festivals for more than a decade. Let's put that into context. If you were brand new, it would probably be a different experience.
Maybe, yes.
Okay.
Maybe. I will say that it is getting harder and harder to cover. And it was always hard, okay? So don't get me wrong. It wasn't ever, you know, a cakewalk. But Park City, Utah is a ski town, okay? And it has one movie theater in it. They screen movies at the high school auditorium, which holds 1,200 people, mainly because it was built knowing that Sundance took place here. They have a screening room in hotels and, you know, the Egyptian theater.
It's cats as cats can.
Yeah. So, but years ago, they never used to talk about the films that were played beforehand. You never heard a programmer saying, oh, you better watch out for, Winter's Bone. That's going to be a good one.
Well, isn't that helpful?
It is helpful and not. And what I mean by that is it would be helpful if they said, okay, here's some films to look out for. You know, Birth of a Nation, which we talked about. I think we talked about that up front. Or, you know, I don't know, Holy Hell or some other movie.
By the Sea. Are they not? What's the biggest venue that they have?
Well, the biggest venue is that 1,200 seat auditorium.
And okay. they do not do at Cannes. You have the same thing where you have one big venue and they have competition films, which Sundance doesn't technically have as far as just a dozen or so movies. But they pretty much everything is eligible. But at Cannes, they say, here are the 10, 15, 20 movies you really have to see. We're going to put them in the biggest venue we have. Everybody's going to want to see these movies. And that's where they're playing. Sundance, you're saying, does not do that.
No, they say, here are all of our movies, 400 of them, and these 17 are competition, and they're playing against these other competition films, and good luck.
But they knew if they said in advance that this movie is a big movie, that they should play it in the big venue. That's obviously politics.
Well, they do, and they usually play it in that venue, but they don't invite the press and industry to that venue. You have to get special tickets. Sometimes they're available.
Oh, that venue's not for the press.
Most of the time, they are not. No, the venue for the press is 160 seats.
When do they start screening the films at the big venue? Is it all day long?
Oh, it's all day long, and it's usually premieres.
So it's not like they have premieres at night they could have press screenings in the morning.
Could they have press screenings all day long?
9 a.m.? Could they have a press screening at the big venue?
Yes. Well, it's the first showing of the day is a combined public and press and industry screening.
Which is at what time?
8:30 in the morning, 9 o'clock.
So you're saying make it just press?
No. That is fine. The way they do that and handle that at 8:30 in the morning is fine. But if you're going to talk up a film like Birth of a Nation for weeks ahead of time, I mean, they never used to talk about these films. It was a democracy.
But I mean, I don't think the problem is that they're talking up films. The problem is how they program and show them to you and make sure that you can see the movies that they know are going to be the hot property. Because it doesn't matter if they don't say anything and it's still the big hot movie and everybody knows it is and they're all buzzing about it. It doesn't matter what they do. What matters is how they screen it. So you're saying they're doing a bad job of making movies available to the press so they can actually cover the movies that are the big hot movies of Sundance.
All they had to do was move that press and industry screening of Birth of a Nation over to that screening room, and it would have been taken care of. This film will win the Sundance Film Festival this year. I could have told you that before the festival started.
Well,
because of the way the programmers were talking about it, because of the way they continued to talk about it in the weeks leading up to it. And because of the time frame that we're set in. With all this talk about diversity.
Well, it's not growing pains. Why are they not doing a better job of making the...
I don't know. That's a good question. And I think a part of it might be they know it's an issue. And you know what? It's one of those issues they choose not to fix. To their credit, last year, when The Witch, at 8:30 in the morning on the very first day of the festival...
A movie I have no idea what it is. I've never heard of it.
Oh, well...
It
did quite well here. I don't know whether it was released or not yet. I don't think it was.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Let's keep in mind how Sundance excitement, you know, sometimes disappears. But anyway.
Oh, look, Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, okay? Right. I kind of had good feelings about that leading into the festival last year because of the way the programmers were talking about it in the media, national media like the New York Times and USA Today, etc., and trade publications like Hollywood Reporter and Variety. Okay. The way they were talking about it, it got picked, it got released.
I got shut out of that. I didn't like it, but you know.
Okay, well, just to your point, I got shut out of that film not once, not twice, three times last year. I got shut out of that film trying to see it, okay? It got picked up for $10 million, was released to no box office whatsoever, and completely overlooked during award season, and now it's just another title on somebody's DVD show.
It wasn't overlooked at award season. It didn't deserve to be part of the award season. It's not that good.
The Witch gets released
in February of 2016, by the way. So it comes out in a few weeks. So we'll have to see where that...
I think it's getting to a point, Michael, where I'm questioning after 17 years of coming here whether it's worth coming anymore.
Well,
because it is
here
so
we
difficult.
Are. Here we are. It's a year and everybody's excited by Sundance. Birth of a Nation is a big movie. Kenneth Lonergan had his comeback film with Manchester by the Sea.
Well, comeback film. He's only made three movies and this is his third movie.
This is a comeback film. This is a redemption story. This is a guy whose career went into a black hole. He wasn't doing anything in theater. He wasn't doing anything in film. He got sucked up by the travesty of Margaret, his last film, and the editing of that, and the nightmare scenario that came out from that. And it seemed to stifle this incredibly creative talent who was doing film on theater and in movies and doing great work. And suddenly it all stopped for years, and it's been 8 years. So yes, this is a comeback work for Kenneth Lonergan, who has done crap on stage since Margaret and done nothing in film since Margaret. It sucked up his life, and now here he is back tentatively, scarily, with a movie that was immediately got the best reviews of Sundance and definitely better reviews than Birth of a Nation.
Well, that's the thing about Sundance. Okay, that's a perfect example. So this year, I got into Manchester by the Sea, and much like it's frustrating to get shut out of films like Birth of a Nation, Manchester by the Sea was absolutely fantastic.
But you got in not through any smartness on their part? Was it moved to a bigger venue?
Nope, it was not moved to a bigger venue. Just as many people got shut out of Manchester by the Sea. Now, mind you, that film is not in competition, okay?
Oh.
And it was a big film going into the festival because, and here's the other little trendy story for this year, Amazon picked up that film before the festival even started.
Well, that happens. That happens repeatedly, but I didn't know it wasn't in competition. That's interesting.
No, and that's why
I thought everything was a Sundance.
No, not at all. Oh. Not at all.
All right. Yes, before the record-setting snag for Birth of a Nation, the big story was Amazon and Netflix. Amazon picked up 4 movies, including Manchester by the Sea, so far. Netflix had picked up 3 movies, including The Fundamentals of Caring with Paul Rudd and Tallulah with Ellen Page. And so those were the big kahunas. They were making all the deals. Sony Picture Classics picked up 2 movies. Lionsgate picked up a movie. But the big deals, the big noise was Amazon and Netflix. And I was going to say, hey, this is how every few years there's some new big buyer in town and they want to prove themselves and they throw money around and they make big deals to show, hey, I'm here to play. Right. So even though it's the streaming services and it feels like, oh, it's totally game changing, it's just what happens every 4 or 5 years. Some new player comes in.
The game changing aspect here will be, will these films get a theatrical release? In other words, are they picking them up and they're going to go straight to streaming? And if they don't get a theatrical release, will it matter? Well, even if they get a theatrical release, will it matter? Okay, will more people see these films on these streaming services than will see them in theaters, which, by the way, is kind of true anyway. But in other words, will it make a bigger impact when released, usually day and date, at the same time on streaming and in theaters? Where will it make the bigger impact?
Well, that's not what Amazon wants. Amazon says they want a full theatrical release and they want to get as wide and complete a release before it comes onto Amazon Prime. Their idea is not day and date.
Okay.
And they said, look, we want Manchester by the Sea. They've committed to an Oscar campaign. Best director, best film, best actor, Casey Affleck. They believe in the movie. They did not buy theatrical distribution rights. It's not clear to me from.
Wait, you're saying they didn't buy theatrical distribution rights?
Except that's not what the trade said. What the trade said was that theatrical rights are still available. Variety said Amazon has closed a deal for domestic rights to Manchester by the Sea, and they will have to find a theatrical distributor.
Okay, because they don't have themselves.
Right, so they're going to pay. They're going to get a deal where somebody just distributes the movie, right?
Because they don't have. Yeah, they don't have the infrastructure to do theatrical distribution.
Right.
So they basically will go and do an output deal somewhere where it's just 15% of the gross and
so they won't
ticket
be the
sales.
So that means somebody will have a deal, but they it'll be an output deal as opposed to it's their film. They're going to just like Fox was the distributor for Star Wars ultimately the last few movies, but they didn't own them.
Correct. And you mean the prequels.
The prequels,
they did not.
Right.
Correct. That was a distribution service deal.
So this is why Amazon maybe beat out Netflix for Manchester by the Sea. And this is why Amazon and Netflix did not win the bid for Fox Searchlight.
Birth of a Nation.
In fact, Fox Searchlight won that. They paid $17.5 million. It's the most money ever paid for a film at Sundance. It's the biggest deal in Sundance history. Netflix reportedly bid $20 million.
And they, really?
Yes, that's according to Variety.
Wow.
They said we want an actual distributor to deal with this movie, which brings up the fact that Cary Fukunaga was very pissed what Netflix did with Beasts of No Nation. You got to work hard to have a movie that has some vague Oscar potential and only make $90,000 at the box office. And he felt like Netflix completely dumped his movie and didn't care about theatrical and didn't make it happen. And so,
well, I think, but that
Netflix,
said,
and Netflix does not care about theatrical as much. And so that's clear. And so some people said, hey, at least people will see our movie. I'll take the paycheck from Netflix. And others said, you know what? I want theatrical. And that's apparently what happened with Birth of a Nation.
Well, and this may be a learning lesson for Netflix. Okay. I think they played it their way the first time. And now they come to Sundance and they make a better offer with more money. And what does the talent and the producers and the content owners say, thanks, we're going to go with the lower offer and guarantee ourselves a theatrical distribution. So, and that, by the way, is it often happens when you have to choose between distributors. You'll go with the one who you think will back the film more. Absolutely. And if you get a reputation for not backing your films, the films that you acquire,
or dropping
the films
them, or
that you
letting
make,
them sit on a shelf, et cetera.
Yeah, you will basically begin to turn off talent. Now, they have done a very good job on the television side of not turning talent off. In fact, doing quite the opposite.
Well, they do a great job. They get nominations, they get attention, they get, you know, glory, and they get money.
And this is Netflix we're talking about. However, in theatrical, feature films, we'll see what happens. Obviously, history has yet to record that.
Yes, so that's the big news from Sundance. Birth of a Nation, of course, is a passion project for actor Nate Parker.
Yes.
And he I'm not sure if he co-wrote it or he wrote it. He directed, he stars in it. It's about the slave rebellion led by Nat Turner. It's gotten rapturous reviews. It's, of course, tapping into the zeitgeist. He put his own money into the movie. He turned down acting jobs until he could make this movie happen. It's got every possible angle for selling it. So it's still a big gamble, $20 million practically, for this movie, for this period piece about a slave rebellion. That's still but they've got all the possible buzz elements you could hope for. The reviews were very positive, but both Variety and Hollywood Reporter did have caveats, which I didn't see for Manchester by the Sea. That's why I pointed that out. So I'm interested in seeing it. I'm excited to seeing it. I'm not sure that we'll have the complete rapturous critical acclaim that they need and hope for in order to get it to another level. But certainly next year, come Oscar time, if they're looking for some movies that can help, hey, we're not, you know, mind you, 2 years ago, 12 Years a Slave won the Best Picture. That doesn't.
Oh, wait. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
That doesn't
actually
inoculate you, does it?
No. We'll talk about that, okay? Because that is a point we'll be making later. By the way, it's Nate Parker. It's a biopic of Nat Turner.
Did I say Nate Turner?
Nat Parker, which, by the way, I've done myself. So, and I've heard other people doing too. It's very confusing. There are too many Nates and Nats in that particular.
So talking about Oscars 2017 brings us back to Oscar 2016, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, should we go over a few of the buzzworthy films here? Or do you want to do? You know, why don't
if
we
you
do
saw
that
it
next
and
week?
Loved it, yeah, let's do it next week when you can wrap.
We'll
up
do that things. Next week. Okay, so then let's move on to Oscar news. Then is that where you were headed?
Yes, the PGA Awards, of course.
Oh, okay. So I guess what? Now The Big Short took home that award, right?
Yep. And which means people say, now that's the front runner. Or as I say, there hasn't been a front runner all season.
It's the front runner of the week.
Right. So, you know, it was looking like maybe it was Spotlight versus The Revenant. Now The Big Short. It won the Producers Guild. Then we'll have the DGA, we'll have SAG. They will either clarify or muddy the picture even more. In other categories, that's a little clearer. Inside Out won Best Animated Film. Amy won Best Documentary. So at least producers think those were the two best accomplishments of the years. And some of the people who vote for the PGA Awards also vote for the Oscars. That's why we care about the guilds.
You did mention, I guess, do we really want to go down the whole list of Game of Thrones?
They're in our show notes. They did good job in TV, better than the Emmys.
What, Game of Thrones, you mean?
Well, Game of Thrones was Best Drama, Fargo Season 2, Best Miniseries, Transparent. Won Best Comedy, and John Oliver won Best Talk Show.
Okay, well, maybe the John Oliver thing is a big deal. I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, I don't know that the television stuff is all that important, is what you're trying to get at.
No, you can say it's a big deal for John Oliver.
Okay, then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Apparently, my getting shut out of Birth of a Nation, overhyped nonsense, by the way.
Exactly.
Our first story today, the head of Viacom is so ashamed of how much money he made in 2015 that he lied about it in a press release. CEO Philippe Demain was mocked for making $44 million in 2014 despite heading a company, okay, was in charge of a company that had been underperforming compared to its competitors. So a few days ago, they announced Philippe Demain would only be making $37 million, a salary cut they probably imagine would tamp down any, either laughter or disgust. I don't know. Michael, in fact, reacted to this by texting me. His salary was cut. He was going to start a Kickstarter campaign for Philippe Demain. Not to worry, though. Press releases may lie, but regulatory filings are a different matter. Turns out Demain's total compensation will be $54 million, which is a $17 million raise. That's practically a 50% raise from the $37 million that was reported. And how did Viacom do in 2015? its stock has fallen 43% in the last fiscal year. Big deal or big whoop?
I should say it's a $10 million raise from what he made in 2014. It's a $17 million raise from the imaginary figure that they offered up at first. It's a big deal that they lied about it and were so ashamed of what he made. It deserves mockery. Not that that will change anything, but, you know, it's kind of telling.
Penske Media, the media company whose portfolio includes Variety, Deadline Hollywood, and more, has acquired IndieWire. As of yet, it's unclear as to what, if any, editorial changes will be made. The fate of Thompson on Hollywood, who, of course, the editor over there is Ann Thompson, a regular guest here on Showbiz Sandbox. And ironically, IndieWire was launched literally 20 years ago, right around Sundance, by Eugene Hernandez, Mark Rabinowitz, and Sherry Barner. Now they've been acquired on the eve of another Sundance by the owners of Variety, the very company that reported on their formation 2 decades ago. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? The big get bigger. Like, eventually, yeah, you just get sucked up into another, you know, you don't want to survive. It's hard to survive on your own. They did it for 20 years, though, didn't they?
They did. And there's, you know, it's also, you know, which path do you take? I think they got into a situation where they were owned by a company that wasn't really going to put any more resources behind them to get them to the next level. So it was either sell yourself to somebody who could put those resources behind you or find an investor that could buy you out and put those resources in. And yeah, so I think there's been some talk of, oh, they've sold out. I don't think that's the case at all. I think they needed somebody to put those resources in, and that's what they found in Penske.
All right.
Now, Michael, that brings us to the Grammys, which have nothing to do with my being shut out of Birth of a Nation, actually.
Okay.
Okay. Michael, by the way, you have been beating me in our personal Grammy pool every single year. We wait until right before the winner is announced. Okay, right before the envelope gets ripped open, and you've been right, like, what, 99% of the time? So now I find out the Grammys have been on tape delay for the West Coast. No more. This year, for the first time in Grammy history, they will air live nationwide. I'm sure somebody's writing in now to tell me when that,
in
you know,
57
I'm wrong.
Or something, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. When Adele and The Weeknd and Kendrick Lamar and the likes of, you know, all of those folks, when they sing their songs, we'll be watching at the same time. And maybe now I can win a bet or two. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Of course, it doesn't really matter, except it's nice that you don't have to get everything spoiled by, you know, online stuff. It reminds me of my childhood in Bermuda. My brother David used to get the other siblings to bet on sports games, which had already happened. Of course, they didn't air in Bermuda until like the next day or two, because they had to fly the tape in. So they would air sports things on TV on tape, and then it would already be in the paper that morning, so he would already know the results.
So he would bet on them? No.
He'd get my siblings. Yeah, he'd say, oh, who's going to win this football game? Who's going to win this? You know, he'd already know. Yeah. It had already happened the day before. There was no internet back then. It's a whole different world.
Hello, Bette. And that's Bette Midler, who enjoyed a personal triumph with her one-woman show, I'll Eat You Last, at Chat with Sue Mengers, which I saw, by the way, at the Geffen Playhouse. It was good. It was a love fest for critics and audiences, like myself. Now, Midler has committed to returning to Broadway in 2017. The vehicle? Hello, Dolly. The blockbuster musical that became a vehicle so closely linked to star Carol Channing that they simply trotted it out every few years with the inimitable Channing doing her thing. Now Midler will tackle the role of the matchmaker, a sassy and winning gal that seems tailor-made for her gifts. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's never been done properly since Carol, I mean, just latched onto the role and never let go. Bless her heart. She deserved to do that. But it'll be fun to see the show freshly done, see what it can be. And she's going to certainly be paid nicely. According to the New York Post, Bette Midler will get $150,000 a week, plus a cut of the merchandise, plus a cut of the box office. And she'll make even more if the show grosses more than $1 million a week, which early on, at least, I'm certain it will.
Oh, I guarantee it will. I mean,
well,
come
that's
on.
A lot. $1 million a week is a lot, but Bette Midler in that show is a great draw. So is Cats, which is returning to Broadway this summer.
Well, I don't understand why this is news. I mean, let's face it. It's Cats now and forever. What part of forever did you not understand?
That was a great tagline, one of the great ad taglines. They just said Cats now and forever. And it was the longest running show in Broadway history. It ran for 18 years. It certainly felt like forever. I've never seen it. I'm looking forward to checking it out.
You've never seen it?
Nope.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's better than Hamilton. I'm going to see it again and again.
Keep going.
Oh, come on. That's the big joke. You know, it's better than Cats. I'm going to see it again.
I get it. Except It's not a joke when it's an actually good show. That people didn't like Cats. They turned on it. That's why it's a joke.
Yes, correct.
They never made that joke about, you know, Guys and Dolls or Hamilton or, you know, My Fair Lady. It doesn't work.
And in 1983, when Cats was first on Broadway, you know, it was kind of divisive. It was this big popular hit, but all the critics were like, eh. You know, so the joke was, oh, it's better than Cats. I'm going to see it again and again, because people would go back to see Cats 50 times. And so thus the joke. We've just now explained a joke that's 30 years old. Speaking of things that are old, hey, how about those X-Files? Just as the X-Files returns to TV in a miniseries, we learn that the truth is out there. You just have to ask. In fact, you should ask actress Gillian Anderson, who famously fought for equal pay on the original series, gaining more leverage when it became a smash hit, and finally receiving something similar to her co-star David Duchovny. So, of course, once the battle was won, she had to fight it all over again. Yes, Anderson told The Hollywood Reporter and others that when it came time for the revival, her deal was about, you know, half of what her male co-star David Duchovny was offering. And this is a quote. She reads, "It was shocking to me, given all the work that I had done in the past to get us to be paid fairly. I worked really hard toward that and finally got somewhere with it. And then it happened again. I don't even know what to say about it." End quote. Well, I do, Michael. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's kind of shocking, really. I mean, it really is. I mean, if anything, they were both unknowns when the show began, and they're both big stars in their own ways. I mean, she does a lot of film and TV work. She got Emmy nominations. He had Californication. I mean, it's just insane. They're both at the same level. If not, she's perhaps even a bigger draw, perhaps, arguably, in some ways, certainly as far as film work is concerned. So the idea that they were paid, she was paid half back then. Why? They were co-stars. And now it's just, it lets you know how much work there is to do in Hollywood, which we'll get back to in Inside Baseball.
That is correct. Now, this is a sad bit of news. In New York City, the last gasp of the iconic Ziegfeld movie theater has finally been heard. I have so many.
That's the last gasp.
Okay, I didn't. And you think my jokes are bad. Okay.
I think you have a lot of memories about the Ziegfeld.
Hello. Grew up in New York. Went to college in New York. Not.
You seem so L.A.
Okay, well.
That's
Ziegfeld.
That's an insult.
I know that. complaining that I can't get into Birth of a Nation.
Yes.
You know, that's the running joke in every one of these stories will be that I did not get into Birth of a Nation. And then my crying about it. For those of you who don't know, Ziegfeld is a vestige of the era when single-screen movie palaces dominated the landscape. The Ziegfeld has been limping along for years in New York City. Even when it booked a big movie, the poorly located house was often half empty. It stayed open, really, only so it could house movie premieres, most recently for the likes of The Big Short and Joy. Now it's been turned into a corporate space, or it's being turned into a corporate space called the Ziegfeld Ballroom. Somewhere, Florence Ziegfeld is rolling over in his grave. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. The house has been dead for years. I've been astonished that it was still open. I couldn't figure out why and how. I mean, it just clearly was a loss leader. Movies, nobody would go see a movie there. It was great because I could go see a movie opening weekend. If Star Wars played there, it was probably a half-empty house. The problem was that they only showed it in 3D, so I didn't bother. But, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame. I'll miss it. But, you know, it's long overdue.
Well, and we should point out that it was one of the biggest houses in New York. I think it held 1,800 people?
Yeah, something like that. It was a great, huge, old-fashioned space. It was awesome.
So when people said, oh, well, it's half empty. Well, yeah, but that means 600 people were seeing the movie.
Oh, it was way empty, though.
Yeah.
No, in the last few years, it's really been a ghost town.
Well, and they were also showing He Named Me Malala when I was last in New York. So I don't know that was a big
movies. It was hard for them to book movies because nobody would go there. You know,
well, there were, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's all a vicious circle, but it's just it's a relic of a past era. It just doesn't work anymore.
You know, we've been talking about a lot of things on this show that don't work anymore, like, I don't know, television ratings. Hmm. Okay. We know your new TV show only reached 4 million viewers, but is it buzzy? I mean, that's been the big thing, Michael. We don't know how many people are watching, and we've been trying to figure out ways to measure. Now Nielsen wants to help you answer the question of, is it buzzy or not? They're joining RentTrack and other services in trying to create a metric that can define a TV show's water cooler ranking. In fact, maybe that's what they should call it. RentTrack measures quote-unquote stickiness and quote-unquote social activity. and gives a quote-unquote social media rank. There's a lot of quote-unquotes.
Yeah, you got to stop that.
Little air quotes. Others list who topped Twitter during the past week, as well as which show's audience was the most Twitter crazy. Now Nielsen is diving in further. They're teaming with Facebook to measure a show's social content ratings, a metric that also includes a TV show's ability to move the dial on Twitter. Because generating a lot of tweets does exactly what for the bottom line of a TV show? I don't know. Actually, according to the New York Times, and this is a quote from them, media companies have tapped Nielsen's Twitter TV ratings as a tool to develop and market shows. Advertisers have used them to help decide where to spend their budgets. Executives said that the goal is for the expanded social ratings to become even more integral to the industry. End quote. But you know what isn't quoted? What you're about to tell me, whether this is a big deal or a big whoop.
It's a big whoop.
What?
You don't agree?
Let me check Twitter and I'll tell you.
First, let's try and figure out who's watching TV shows, because they're still not doing a good job on that. Before you try to get into some vague, fuzzy idea of like, just because somebody posts a tweet about a show, does it mean they liked it? Did they not like it? You don't even know what the quality is of their comment. Or, you know, so I mean, that's so hard to do. But the fact is that Nielsen and Rentrak and no one is doing a good job of capturing and telling the world who's watching TV shows and in what level. Like between, you know, the network and DVR and the network websites and the TV show websites and Hulu and all this stuff. We don't even know how many people are watching TV shows within a month of when it airs. They're not doing a good job of that yet. So why don't you stick to your knitting, figure that out, and then you can try doing some fakakta thing like how sticky is it?
Do you think I have to bleep out the word fakakta?
Of course not. It's Yiddish.
It's Yiddish, but it, you know, what if somebody...
It's fine.
Okay, just checking. You know, speaking of checking on things, it's not easy when the driving force of a company holds on to power into old age. Look at Sumner Redstone. He's become increasingly invisible publicly as presumably ailing health takes its toll on the 92-year-old who once ran Viacom with an iron hand. Lawsuits are swirling around him now. An ex-companion, and can I use the air quotes for that? Ex-companion and caregiver?
I don't think you need to.
Okay, well, she's suing, claiming those around Redstone have blocked the truth about his mental capacity, ability to make decisions for himself, and even forged his signature on documents. Now a shareholder is saying Viacom and CBS have betrayed their obligation to shareholders by remaining loyal to Redstone, and in part, his daughter Sherry, who is a key executive. The suit says if Redstone is not capable of making personal decisions about his care, as the other lawsuit alleges, why are Viacom and CBS paying him tens of millions of dollars for performing duties he perhaps cannot actually perform? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. And the judge has finally ruled that, yes, a third party can examine Redstone and see about his mental capacity and ability to make decisions for himself. You know, it's control over massive international companies. So, yeah, it's going to impact a lot of people in a lot of ways.
I agree. Adele has set another record with her video for Hello.
Hello.
Directed by, hey, don't sing too much of it, otherwise, you know, we'll have to pay royalty. The video was directed by Xavier Dolan from Canada. The clip raced to 1 billion views on YouTube faster than any other in history, even size, hitting the mark in just 88 days. That's twice as quick as the previous record holder, as I just mentioned, Psy's Gangnam Style. Yes, we'd already forgotten about that, the one-hit wonder, Psy, as well, but he's now at, by the way, 2.5 billion views. 17 songs are in the 1 billion club, including, most recently, Maroon 5's Sugar and Eminem's Love the Way You Lie with Rihanna. Of course, these records are made to be broken, right? I mean, Adele held the record for most views in a 24-hour span when Hello debuted and hit 36 million views. She was topped almost immediately by David Bowie, who hit 51 million views the day after he died. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop. It's just a silly minor little thing. How quickly do you get to 1 billion on YouTube? But the bizarre thing is I was actually trying to catch that moment, because I think I mentioned on the show I actually was the 23rd person to watch the video.
And what?
Did I not mention that?
No.
Oh, wow.
Are you serious?
Yes, yes, yes. I was awake at like 3 or 4 in the morning, and they released the video. You know, they sent an email saying, oh, the video's posted. And for some reason, the link did not quite work quickly and take me to where I needed to be. I had to like work for a minute and go back and try again. And finally, I got to Vimeo and I played the video because I knew it was directed by...
Wait, on Vimeo or YouTube?
It's the same thing. It's the
same. No, Vivo and YouTube. Those views count.
I mean, Vivo. Yeah, it was Vivo. Yeah, no, okay. Trust me. It's the thing I looked at is now at the same, is that, you know, I had the screenshot. It's the actual same thing. So it's at 20. When I did it, I watched it because Xavier Dolan directed it, and I was interested. And then I was like, oh, I'm number 23. Oh, that's kind of funny. And I took a screenshot at it. And I said, oh, man, this is going to have tens of millions of views. You know, of course it will. It's Adele. I'm forgetting what the world is now for videos. But if I hadn't taken time, I probably would have been top 10. And I assume that they probably watched it once or twice just to make sure it was working properly. So I assume I couldn't have been number one. But I mean, I opened that email the second it came out, you know, and immediately clicked on it. I'm sure people were already registered to Adele, and at 3 a.m. they saw the video was online and they dinged and watched it immediately. But still number 23.
Also, remember, you know, there's a, you know, it's a 24-hour world. You yes, know, so exactly. There are people on the other side of the world
but
that were
getting
it.
I was still number 23, and I thought, well, that's kind of fun. And then it was getting close to a billion. I thought, I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to try to be the 1 billionth person, which is probably a thing that people do, even though it's only happened 17 times. And I thought, I'm going to pay attention. And I was literally looking at it like every hour, boom, it blew by.
and most of those people who tried to be the billionth were online with me getting shut out of Birth of a Nation.
Oh, God. Okay.
Keep moving. Okay. Since I keep referencing Sundance, maybe we should. Yeah, this one sounds interesting. Netflix may not divulge figures about viewership of its shows. We talked about that last week, but they're happy to share some numbers. To be precise, they beat expectations in the fourth quarter of 2015, adding more new subscribers than expected and passing 75 million subscribers worldwide on the first day of 2016. I wouldn't necessarily say they're happy as much as obliged to, since they're a public company. Their new subscriber numbers were slightly lower than predicted in the US, but they're still adding subscribers. Netflix also says it hit $1.6 $7 billion in revenue, lower than predicted, but reaching 3 cents per earnings per share, better than the 2 cents that were expected by analysts. Big deal or big whoop?
So your head spins here for me, because first they say, oh, it's not good news. Look how quickly they're slowing down in North America. So it's a big deal because it's bad news for Netflix. And then a minute later, their stock is going up because everybody says, well, yeah, but their earnings, you know, the earnings per share were better and they're still growing worldwide. And that's where they're growing. I mean, it's a mature business. So why would they keep galloping ahead in North America? So then the shares jump up a lot. So, you know, it's hard to keep track of. Is this good news? Is it bad? Hey, they're growing.
Well, and you know, right, that once those subscriber numbers begin to really plateau, you know what's going to happen, right?
What?
They have to raise the price.
Well, and they have before, and they will again. But they don't have, really. But at some point, you say, I'm a mature business.
Yeah, and they're
and you
pretty
say
much
we've developed enough original content that we don't need to make these blockbuster deals anymore. You know, they were paying top dollar for all the content that they have from other people. At some point, they'll say, we've got enough of a library and there's enough other bidders. We don't have to pay that big amount anymore. You know, they don't. So, I mean, their cost for buying those libraries for certain periods of time will come down a little bit because they were at peak dollar value. They'll have enough original content that they'll feel like they have more leverage. They don't have to depend on getting every title from every person. They've already proven that. So I think it'll be a mature business. They won't grow a lot. Maybe they'll raise another dollar eventually, but they'll also lower costs by not having to shell out so much money and having a bunch of their own library.
The real story here, and this is what to look at, is that $1.67 billion in revenue was lower than predicted by analysts. Okay, those same analysts predicted that at that higher figure, okay, the higher amount that they thought that
they'd only
Netflix
make 2 cents
earn,
per share.
That they'd only make 2 cents per share. However,
so
at the lower figure,
cost.
Well, wait, at the lower figure, they made 3 cents per share, meaning that their margins are very profitable.
The margins are profitable and they're lowering their expenses.
Correct.
Yeah, which is what we're talking about.
Exactly. But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into yet the next fight we're going to have during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Okay, I don't even know where do you want to begin on this? We're going to be talking about the Academy Awards and the diversity issue that has basically everybody talking, whether you're in Hollywood or out of Hollywood, you're talking about this.
Well, Spike Lee talked about it and he said, hey, I didn't tell anyone to boycott the Oscars. I didn't say boycott. I just said I'm not going and my wife isn't going.
Well,
that's
okay.
What he said. And then, the Oscar producer said, Chris Rock is rewriting his monologue right now to talk about, you know, Oscars so white. And Chris Rock's manager said, shut up. You don't know what he's writing or doing or not doing. And he'll be the one to tell you what he's doing and not doing. And the only person that speaks for Chris Rock is Chris Rock. So that was a little tiff between the producers and Chris Rock, who is going to host the show. And then
Can I put a little tab in that? I'd like to just put a little tab in that as a reminder for later, but keep going.
Okay. And we have two veteran actors illuminating the mind of Oscar voters, Charlotte Rampling and Michael Caine. And I would also say that from certain press reports, we've seen that everybody in the Academy is furious at the suggestion that they're racist, or as we should properly say, racially biased, which is the difference. You know, racist means I hate black people. Racially biased means you just vote for the movie you like the most and feel the most comfortable about and identify with more. And perhaps you skipped over Straight Outta Compton, but it's just because it wasn't quite your thing. That's what we're talking about. Charlotte Rampling said the boycott is racist to white people. Maybe your performance wasn't good enough.
Oops. Did she really say it that way?
She absolutely did say it that way. And then immediately had to apologize and say, oh, she was misinterpreted. In other words, she said it, but she didn't mean it. Or rather, she didn't mean you to take what she meant the way she meant it.
Right. I mean, because the way it was reported. Now, mind you, I was reading this while standing in line for Birth of a Nation, which I got shut out of. Uh-huh. And it was basically the way it was reported was, hey, she was trying to say, you know, hey, shouldn't the best man win? No pun intended.
Reading the apologia. The original one was, you know, the accurate quote from her saying it's racist to white people and maybe your performance wasn't good enough. You know, she's like, hey, you know, Michael Caine said, be patient, black people. No, I'm sorry. He said, be patient, black people. I had to wait a long time to win an Oscar.
Now, don't you think in part, I'm not defending him at all. I'm just wondering if like he was meaning it like as a joke, like look how long it took. My 60s.
No, he wasn't joking. And in fact, yes, it took a long time for him to win an Oscar, but he got nominated pretty much right off the bat. He got his first nomination in 1966 for Alfie. He was 33 years old. And while he had a lot of TV credit and some uncredited minor roles, pretty much it was his third film role of any substance whatsoever. So he did not have to wait a long time to get nominated. And that's a great illumination of the mind of the Oscar voter. They're older. They're white. Perhaps they don't mean ill, and they may even be liberal in their politics and what they say and do, but perhaps they're also a little clueless.
That might be true. I mean, how many of the Oscar voters actually saw Straight Out of Compton? That's my question. How many saw Creed? And how many voted for Sylvester Stallone because they heard, oh, I heard he was good in that. And, you know, hey, it's Sylvester Stallone. He's trying to make a comeback. You know what?
Racial bias would say they did see them or they watched most of them and they did watch Creed and they did watch whatever, but they just went for the movie that they identified. Subtle racial bias means that it's not that you go, I don't like black people. It's just that you just tend to focus on and lean towards and identify with the movies that with people who look like you.
How many people saw Concussion? Not a lot of people saw that at the movie theater.
Get any good reviews?
Exactly. So
no, that's not about the issue of each movie and why they did not or did not get nominated. Because there's good arguments to be made for all of them as far as why they're not typical Oscar bait or didn't get good reviews. The question is image. Image is everything. There's the impression that the Academy is racially biased. And so now the Academy is going to take steps to give the impression that it's not. They had a big board meeting, which apparently includes 51 people.
Huge board meeting. We have 6,000 members. We had 51 of them over, and we made some decisions.
Almost 10. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of people on board, but there's 6,261 members of the Academy, and they had a big meeting to try and figure out what they should do. There were a lot of proposals floating in the air. We'll go over about four or five of them and tell you what they were, how smart they are, and what actually happened.
Okay, well, where do you want to start?
The top of the list.
I don't even know where the top of this list is. Make the best picture list 10 films again? Yep. Is that?
Yep. Yes. What are the pros of that?
Well, you get to like hype 10 films a year. That's kind of cool.
And everybody understands the top 10 films of the year, right? That's a metric everyone understands. The con, of course, is that expanding the list hasn't always brought in the blockbusters that studios wanted. That's why they expanded the list in the first place, not to increase diversity. It was to try and say, hey, why are we excluding big popular movies? Nor will it necessarily do that. So con doesn't mean you're going to do it. So our suggestion is, hey, you know what? No matter what you do, stick to it for at least a decade. If you're going to nominate 10, fine. If you're going to nominate 5, fine. If you're going to go back and forth between 7, 8, 9, and 10, depending on how many people, fine. But just stick to it. Changing your mind every 2 years is annoying.
And what did they do?
Nothing.
Yeah, okay. In 2015, there were 8 movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have to go over.
But if you talk about, they've got this, if Straight Outta Compton had been nominated for Best Picture, this is why we have a list of their last, since they've done this change in polling, how many movies have been there, how many blockbusters, how many films of color. If they just nominated Straight Outta Compton, we wouldn't be having the discussion, right? But so, you know, that there's a much bigger problem that, yes, the Oscars symbolize, but, you know, getting one extra movie on a list is not going to change that actual problem.
Expand the actor categories, maybe?
Yeah, what was the idea there?
Well, you have so many good leading male performances, for instance. No wonder Will Smith didn't make the cut. I mean, there were only five. There's only five nominees. The pros, if there are 10 good movies, surely you've got to have 10 good performances, right?
The cons are that there aren't always, especially for women, unfortunately, not because women aren't as good actors, but because there aren't enough good movies with good roles for women to appear in. Some years they struggle to find five good female lead performances in mainstream Hollywood movies. Believe me, there are 10 great performances a year from women, but they're in foreign films, they're in art house films, etc. So my suggestion is no dice. Don't do it. Too many nominees in acting would look too flabby. What are you, the Globes?
Yeah, that's true. And I didn't realize you were asking me for the cons there as opposed to the pros. What did they do, Michael?
Nothing.
Okay, just checking. Here's a...
Of course, they could do stuff in the future like expand the Oscars to 10 films permanently, which I hope they do. But anyway.
Here's something they could do. They could expand membership, which is, you know, it's already getting, you know, slowly younger and more diverse. But each area has its own membership, remember. They have these different divisions. And they're too onerous and restrictive in a world where so much happens on TV and online.
Yeah, I mean, for example, in the editor's branch, applicants must have, quote, a minimum of 4 theatrical film credits of a caliber, which, in the opinion of the executive committee, reflect the high standards of the Academy. These credits must be principal position screen credits as film editor, with at least 2 being single card credits, end quote. It's like,
and that's basically to prevent people, I mean, the way people get invited to the Academy and nominated to be in the Academy and not nominated for awards, I mean, to be in the Academy, to be an Academy member, that was a way to stop people from, like, getting their friends in. So I get why
yes,
they had
they
certain
have to be
rules
approved anyway. So it's, you know,
yes.
So it doesn't matter. You know, it's, you know. So what are the pros of trying to expand membership?
Well, the pros are you could probably recognize some TV editors, some really good TV editors who also work in film sometimes. And, you know, kind of go back and forth, and who may not have, like, always 3 or 4 single card credits.
Right. And what are the cons?
Well, it kind of cheapens the membership, doesn't it? I mean, just to improve the picks.
Right. And my suggestion would be they should expand the membership quickly and smartly. Somebody said they should have a year of just all people of color, of women and people of color. Next year, they invite like 300 people. Just say this year, we're going to do all people of color or women. You know, of course, there's problems with that. Maybe not have 300 people. But here's the thought. Send out an automatic invite to anyone who's ever nominated or won an Academy Award for any reason whatsoever retroactively. There are all these directors from around the world who've directed foreign films, have been up for Oscar, these classic, you know, Miyazaki just got invited to the Academy. That's crazy. Anybody who's ever got nominated should be eligible. It should be in the membership automatically.
Okay, well, another thought was you could pull a Logan's Run and jump the old people. You know, if you haven't garnered a credit in the last 10 years,
what did they do about, what did they do about expanding membership?
Well, Michael, it's funny you should mention that because that's exactly what the Academy is doing in terms of they said that they are going to double the number of minority and, you know, they're going to diversify is basically
what they
said
they want to. They're going to encourage everyone. They haven't done anything specifically about expanding membership. They've just said, hey, we all need to work on this.
I thought they said that by 2020, they will be doubling
they have
the number.
Goals. They have goals. They have not changed anything or done anything to do that. And you know who should be a member of the Academy? Ice Cube, actor, producer, writer. He's been a strong commercial force for 25 years and made a lot of people a lot of money. If Hollywood can't respect that, what can they respect?
I totally agree
and
with that.
And he's produced a movie that got nominated for Academy Award.
Yeah, I think, and you know what? He definitely. I'm surprised he's not in the Academy.
I'm
frankly,
not surprised
already.
At all because it's an old white boys club.
No.
It is.
That's
of course
if
it
you
is.
You saw who was. I mean, look, I don't agree with that.
What do you mean? There's not. It's not a debate. The Academy is filled with old, aging white people. That's the majority of their membership. That's the
what you said.
Problem.
They were old. You said they were old, right there.
Yes.
Well, maybe they could pull a Logan's Run and dump all the old people. You know, like if you haven't garnered a credit in 10 years, or if you're not working in the past 10 years, you can't vote anymore. What about that?
Well, the pros are it would lower the age of the Academy, I guess, but fast. The cons are it's ageism. Why isn't ageism just as bad as racism and sexism, isn't it? And
yeah.
My suggestion is it's ridiculous. Drop dead. Not you, Academy voters of mature years, but the people who want to dump you should drop dead. Old people aren't the problem. Too few new people are the problem. I mean, is there some metric that they know that, like, if you're older, you're racist? You know? And, like, what problem are you solving by doing this?
Well, what you're doing is you are making sure that people who have a lot of knowledge, who have spent a lifetime working
in... identified is diversity. And this this tweak does nothing to deal with diversity.
I completely agree. And basically what they're saying is you old white people keep voting for the wrong movies or movies that are too biased.
But they don't know that. I know a person who's an Oscar-winning editor who voted for Straight Outta Compton for Best Picture. He's an old white guy. So they don't know that. They have no conceivable way they could know that. So what did they actually do about this? They actually did this. This is the one thing they actually did.
Right? And it pissed everyone
off. Because it was stupid. It was poorly thought out. It's complicated. It's annoying. Nobody knows it applies to them. What they did was they said, okay, there's no automatic lifetime membership unless you get nominated or win an Oscar. And you're in the Academy when that happens. All right. You must work in three different 10-year periods after joining the Academy to maintain lifetime membership. Everybody's pulling out their notepads trying to figure that out. They don't have to be consecutive 10-year periods, by the way, but they do have to be three different 10-year periods. So if you work in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, 1970, and then get a credit in 1992.
So basically, if you're Terrence Malick, okay, if you're Terrence Malick, this applies to you.
Right. And the thing is, I love that they don't have to be consecutive, and it has to happen after you join the Academy, which is great, because if you join when you're 40, which is pretty great accomplishment, right? You're 40, you join the Academy. After that, you have to work in three consecutive decades. And if you miss a decade, all right, we just have to do it again. So it means you join at 40, you 40 and 50, and then you miss a decade. That's okay. Just get another credit in your 70s and you can keep voting. It's just, it has nothing to do with diversity other than age. And it doesn't help anything. It has no impact whatsoever on diversity. It just somehow makes people who've been an Academy members for 40 years feel like they're losers and they don't want them around anymore.
Well, and it perfectly, and frankly, it goes against what the Academy is supposed to represent, which is this achievement that you have actually worked a lifetime to be this
professional. But God
forbid
you not have another 30 years after you get into the Academy. You get into the Academy, you're 50, you know?
Yeah, and by the way, what happens when you're like in your 70s and as some, you know, I read a couple of letters to The Hollywood Reporter and Variety saying, look, I teach now. I'm in my 70s. I'm in my mentor phase, one producer said. I'm there as a director, as a former producer, to teach younger folks how to do that so that they can one day get into the Academy once they've achieved enough in their careers.
It's hateful, it's stupid, it's poorly thought out, it's ridiculous.
But now,
and it's the only actual thing they did other than adding three new seats to the board, which already has, it's bigger than the Politburo. So, like, they're going to make sure that the three new seats, of course, are people of color or women. But it's like, for God's sakes, the board should be half the size it is, not bigger.
Yeah, well, and this speaks to what I was trying to point out earlier. I put a tab in two things, Michael. Mm-hmm. Okay. The first was you mentioned 12 years a slave. And I would like to point out, okay, I'm going to kind of make a really wonky analogy here, but you're a big Yankees fan, right?
Sure.
Do they win the World Series every year?
Not every year.
But they do better than most, right? They kind of won like 26.
They're the most successful sports franchise in history in any sport.
And they're in a huge market. They've got a lot of clout and a lot of buying power. The Royals won this year. Okay, they're not going to win next year, maybe. Maybe they will, but they're not going to win every year for the rest of time.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
They might not even compete. 10 years from now, they may not even have a team that's very good. Okay? Because that's the way cycles work. 2 years ago, you had 12 Years a Slave win. Steve McQueen winning. Yes, he did not win Best Director. Okay? I can't remember. I believe he wasn't nominated for Best Director. I could be wrong about that. But at the same time, Carlos Cuarón from Mexico, El Latino, won for Best Director. Okay, so
for Gravity.
For Gravity, yes. So you know what? Okay, that year you had a lot of diversity. And for 2 years in a row, yes, there has been no diversity. Does that mean next year? Now we know next year, you could almost write the script for next year, much like you could have written the script for this year's Sundance, once you saw Birth of a Nation was one of the films.
Well, if one of 8, 9, or 10 films will be a film of color, yes. But does that mean the problem of diversity in Hollywood is solved? No.
No, not at all. I agree with what's – this is something you will rarely hear from me. I agree with what Spike Lee said. It's not about the awards. It's about the process and about the system in general.
I agree with Spike Lee. Why don't you? What do you disagree with Spike Lee about?
Not much, actually. I don't know why I said that. I just
yeah, Spike Lee. So you've got Paris Barkley, who's the black head of the DGA. You've got Spike Lee. You've got the head of SAG. You've got the head of the Academy. Everybody says, hey, look, there's a much bigger problem here. It's who's in charge in the boardroom and at the major TV networks. And it's the people working up in front of the cameras and behind the cameras day in and day out until all those things change. You know, and it doesn't mean you throw up your hands and you don't do anything, but the problem is much bigger. The Academy reflects the industry. It doesn't influence and set the course for the industry.
Okay, you just said something, and I'd like to pause there for a second, because here's the thing.
You like to
and
pause what, this week.
Yes, because I'm always being stopped before I get into a screening of The Birth of a Nation. I can't let up. What can I
Keep
say?
Going.
But that said, I kind of took a step back this week and went, wait a second. Exactly what you said is true, Michael. The Academy and its nominations reflect the industry at large, okay? So if that's true, we've been complaining for eons now that Hollywood has no originality, that all they do is they make cartoon comic book movies, the 15th installment of a franchise. There's no originality
in
Hollywood.
And the Oscars ignore them.
And when they do the Oscars, yeah, when they do make an original film, the Oscars ignore them.
No. I'm saying they ignore those franchises.
Correct. Okay. So yeah. Okay. But what I will say is you can't say that Hollywood is completely unoriginal and then fault Hollywood for being unoriginal when they do their nominations.
Well, you can fault them for being racially biased and the fact that movies, you know, they should do a better job of reflecting the world around them.
But the movies themselves, for you know, if the movies themselves don't, then
that's
how could
why you need more people of color and gender and sexual orientation in the boardrooms making decisions.
Well, for I don't know how many years, the head of Warner Brothers was an African-American man. So, okay, that's
one. Yeah.
Okay.
Look at the numbers of people who are directors. The women are still pathetically low in the number of directors working in the business.
That I agree with.
Right? Well, so are people of color. Of course.
Not that I've disagreed.
There are counterexamples, but that's, you know, one naming a person does not change the fact.
No, all right. Well.
Yeah.
You know, Amy Pascal was the head of Sony.
That's right.
Bad examples, and she's no longer there, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah.
My other little tab and pause among the many was you said that the producers came out and said, oh, Chris Rock is going to rewrite his. Don't worry, people. Chris Rock is going to address his whole diversity.
I believe it was Reginald Hudlin, so don't, you know.
Okay, no, I understand. But what I'm. This whole thing smacks to me of, and maybe smacks is the wrong word, it's just got a negative connotation, but it seems to me that the Academy is having a knee-jerk response to a lot of things, and they're just throwing stuff against the wall, hoping something sticks so that there won't be this big, giant controversy, and it looks as if they don't know what they're doing.
Well, they don't know what they're doing because they're acting too fast, and they're being stupid, and they should have said, look, this is a complicated issue. We're not, you know, they felt they had to do something and they chose to like punish old people. So that was their big decision. So people can be pissed at them and they should be because that's stupid. Doesn't help anything. But yeah, you know, hopefully they'll catch their breath down the road and they'll, you know, try to think of more substantive and useful things that they can do to increase diversity. They're the ones who choose who gets in. I'm like, well, we can only do the best based on the people who are already in the business. You know, we don't control who gets into the business, just to control. Yeah. There have been plenty of
instead,
people of color
and
women
instead,
who could have been members.
That's what they said about a week ago,
yeah.
Okay? And then this week they said, well, or we could stack the deck. That's what it seemed like they were saying.
Right.
And frankly, I don't think anybody, no matter what race, gender, no matter what your makeup is, I don't think anybody wants that.
Well, I know. Wants what?
For a deck to be stacked.
What are you talking about?
Either for them or against them.
What do you mean for or against who or what? It's not about letting people who are incompetent get jobs. It's about people who are qualified and deserve to have the jobs get access to the jobs, which they can't because of the old boys network.
I'm talking about the Academy itself. I'm not talking about the industry.
Well, what do you mean? If there's people who are qualified to get in the Academy and they've been ignored for decades, that's not stacking the deck to redress decade-long injustice of people not getting into the Academy when they deserve to be. That's not stacking the deck. That's redressing long-standing wrongs.
Well, I haven't. I mean,
I don't know what you mean by stacking.
We don't have time to get into who's been left out. we don't have time for that. But yes, I agree with you. If people have been left out,
of course,
no matter
they
their gender, their race, religion, creed.
Hayao Miyazaki wasn't a member of the Academy. He's had multiple films nominated for Oscars. That's crazy.
What? He's not a member of the Academy?
Just like 2 years ago, they finally made him a member.
You know what? We did cover that. And
yes.
We both remarked on that at the time. Yes.
It's ridiculous.
That was ridiculous.
That's just a gazillion examples of that. Of course, they've done a terrible job of making sure their membership got younger and more diversified. They've done a terrible job. It's their own fault. You can complain about the business in the world, but they decide who enters the Academy. They've done a crappy job.
You heard it here first or second.
And now people have died.
And what a way to get into our obituaries.
Did we talk about Glenn Frey last week? I forget.
I think not. I think it was happening at that day, or
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Glenn Frey of the Eagles died. Obviously, one of the big bands of all time. At one point, the best-selling album of all time, the Eagles' greatest hits.
It still is actually the best-selling.
No, it is not.
It isn't? Well, it's the best-selling album of the 20th century.
No, Michael Jackson's album went back above it after he died. Thriller is the best-selling album of all
time. Of the 20th century, it's
Nobody makes that distinction. And I don't think even that is true. But
it's in the documentary that was made just last year about the Eagles. Irving Azoff holding up the plaque. He's like, well, I guess this record can't be broken since the 20th century is over.
Best-selling album of the 20th century.
Mm, yeah.
They made it by weeks. Whatever. I mean, perfectly valid.
Yeah. I was like, well, that's like any other qualifiers you want to throw in there? Record covers with
blue. Yeah, I mean, it's only been out for 30 years,
Yeah.
It's music in it. Yeah, no. Eagles, big band. Glenn Frey died. Very sad news. It's kind
of. And they just got off tour in July. They just finished touring.
It's cool to see artists all over the world nowadays when Springsteen plays a song in concert or Jackson Brown plays an Eagles song in concert as a tribute. You see the video right away. So that's kind of a fun thing. You don't have to sort of. You can see what respect artists have by the outpouring of affection from other artists and, what they do on stage for them.
Let me ask you this. Do you think without Glenn Frey, the Eagles will ever play live again?
Absolutely.
You do?
Sure.
Who's going to sing for Glenn Frey?
I don't know, but why would they stop touring and making money?
Well, for years.
Why would they stop touring and making money?
You know, when you put it that way, Michael, it almost sounds logical.
It's like you could stop and maybe I'm not saying it'll be a cynical decision. It's like, there are other guys who were involved in the band. Why would, they want to keep going, carrying on the torch and playing the music and, why not?
Well, also passing away this week is Abe Vigoda.
He died at 94. And I think at 94, you just don't even bother explaining why or how he died. He died. He's 94. But he looked like he was 94 back in the 70s and the early 80s when he starred in The Godfather and then in Barney Miller, of course, the great sitcom that he was one of the key supporting actors on. And he's a good example of the danger of getting what you want because he kept getting Kvetchy and demanding more and more money on Barney Miller. He became difficult. They gave him a spinoff called Fish. It lasted one season and it never worked again on back on Barney Miller. So
yeah, but now the old website is abevagodadead.com. We'll actually have something. Finally, after all these years, they can make a change.
That's right. There's a band called Abe Vigoda. He's a regular on Conan, so he's sort of a pop cultural fixture, what's his name?
Don't ask me. Elvis?
Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this website is abevagodadead.com. All it ever said was no, and now I went and looked today, and it says yes. It's kind of cute.
I don't mean to laugh.
Yeah, no,
but
it's sweet. And it says yes, and it has his birth and death date, February of 1921 to January of 2016. I mean, the guy let it, it wouldn't be nice if he died at 40, but, he died at 94. So, and he had a great, late period of having fun and getting attention. And, he's a terrific actor. And he was great on Barney Miller, and, God bless him.
Yeah, it's funny when you said, he died at 94. I thought to myself, you mean 194? Because he was 94 when he appeared in The Godfather Part 1, which was in like 1972.
Exactly. But, so, he had a fun career and made the most of it.
Well, we made the most of this episode of Showbiz Sandbox, I think.
And by the most, we mean really long.
Really long. And that's probably because I had all this free time since I was shut out of Birth of a Nation.
Oh, God.
I had to say it one last time, don't you think?
No, but that's okay.
In any case, You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. We are on Twitter as well. You can find us under @ShowbizSandbox. So ShowbizSandbox is our handle there. You can also find us on Facebook, where if you search for ShowbizSandbox, our page should show up, and please do like us there. That information, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've covered on today's show. Again, that's showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. You can also hear them on the latest episode of Song Exploder, a podcast where artists break down one of their key tracks and explain the creative process. It's a great podcast. Benjamin Goldwasser and Andrew Van... How do you pronounce that? Vanvengarden. I've never known how to pronounce that, Michael. Do you know that?
Yeah, when you're learning.
But you know what? He was my friend on Facebook until, you know, the band was really popular, and then he got off of Facebook.
Oh, wow.
I was like, where is he? I can't contact him anymore. Exactly. Well, they tackle their hit Time to Pretend, offering insight into how the song came to be and a few key expletives as well. So for the timid, just an FYI. We've got a link to it in our show notes. Michael, you have a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week?
I'm sorry, but this week it's Nobody Cares About Press Screenings at Sundance.com.
Well,
it's not true. It's good to give them feedback, and maybe we can make a change.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, let's face
but
it.
But nobody cares about press screenings at Sundance.
Under the definition in Webster's, I have a Webster's dictionary right here. I looked up the definition of first world problem. This was it, actually. Me getting shut out of Birth of a Nation.
The 1% problem, bitch.
Yeah. What did I say?
First world.
Oh. That's okay. Well, I don't know. It's either one. First world problem, 1% problem. That's the definition of it. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.